Our text for this morning's sermon will be Esther chapter 3. Esther chapter 3. Hear now the word of the Lord. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. They told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot. They cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples and all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict according to all that Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples, to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God stands firm and sure forevermore. Beloved congregation of our Lord Jesus Christ, at the conclusion of our sermon on Esther 2 last week Sunday, we were encouraged by the knowledge that God does not leave us where we are. Now, we learned that this is something which proves true in a spiritual sense. God, he doesn't leave us in the sin into which we've cast ourselves, nor does he leave us in death. Rather, he raises up all those who have believed the gospel message, and he raises them up to a new life in him. But it also proves true in terms of our daily lives in this broken and sinful world. All too often, life in this world is hard. And as sinful, finite beings, we don't always respond to our circumstances wisely. We're not always sure what the right thing to do is, and we often lack the conviction and the strength to do the right thing, even when we are able to identify it. But the wonderful message of Esther 2 is that the sovereign God whom we serve, the sovereign God who has also become our Father, he doesn't leave us in these circumstances. Our Father, he doesn't leave us where we are, even when our choices have failed to meet his standards. No, he cares for us, and he safeguards the steps of those whom he's called to himself, and he shows himself to be sovereign, even over their sinfulness and shortcoming, which means that he doesn't leave us as victims of our sin. He doesn't leave us as victims of our circumstances, but he constantly works to turn even those things to our ultimate good. Now, that was the lesson that we learned last week from chapter 2. And learning that lesson, it can leave us feeling a bit confused as we turn ahead to chapter 3. Because last week, we noted how Mordecai's labors in the palace gates, they'd placed him in a position to thwart an attempted assassination of the king. And we learned that his being there in those palace gates and how he heard those words, that was evidence of the Lord's activity in his life. That was evidence that the Lord is indeed present in that story and he is superintending the events of history. In fact, we took it to be evidence of the fact that God was going to move Mordecai, that he was going to take Mordecai from where he was and he was going to lead Mordecai to where he needed to be. But then, at the outset of chapter 3, there is a sudden and a remarkable shift in the narrative. Mordecai's story is suddenly interrupted. It's interrupted by the appearance and even the ascendancy of another court official, a fellow by the name of Haman. And as the chapter unfolds, we watch. We watch first in shock as Haman receives the royal favor that we would have expected Mordecai to receive. And we watch in horror as Haman ruthlessly uses the authority he's been given to plot the extermination of the Jews. And we need to see that there is a harsh reminder for us here, beloved. There's a lesson for us here this morning. There's a harsh reminder that in this sin-darkened world, virtuous behavior doesn't always lead to blessing and security. We like to think that living quiet, peaceable lives, that being good citizens, that it will ensure that not only are we left alone, but that we are perceived as being valuable members of our community, that we're perceived and understood to be important members of our society. But that isn't always the way that things work out for God's people. What we discover is that we're living amidst a wicked and a faithless generation. And it turns out that the sons and daughters of darkness, they are a shockingly forgetful and self-interested bunch. And that is a reality which is underscored for us this morning as we consider the behavior of Xerxes in this chapter. First of all, despite the fact that Mordecai had saved his life and that Mordecai's heroic actions had even been recorded in the Chronicles of the Kings, Xerxes seems to quickly have forgotten about Mordecai's loyalty. So quickly, in fact, that Mordecai isn't even rewarded for saving the king's life. And we need to understand that this forgetfulness on Xerxes' part, it was very much out of character for the Persian kings. If you were to go back and look at the historical record, one of the things you discover is that the Persian kings actually had a proven track record for rewarding loyalty. And they didn't just reward loyalty, they rewarded loyalty in lavish ways. And while Xerxes certainly wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, even Xerxes would have realized that rewarding loyalty was just good business. After all, when you reward the loyalty of your subordinates, it has the effect of creating a group of people who are now personally invested in your success. The people below you now have a vested interest in keeping you in power because their prosperity is tied to yours. But on this occasion, Xerxes forgets. And Mordecai's service, it actually goes unrecognized, and his loyalty to the crown is quickly forgotten. Ultimately, however, as we move on in this chapter, what we discover is that Xerxes doesn't just prove to be forgetful. Xerxes is also displayed as being remorselessly self-interested. Look ahead, if you would, in the text to verse 8 for a moment. And consider how Haman presents his genocidal plot to the king. Haman comes to Xerxes, and what does he say to him? He says, "A certain people who have different laws ought to be exterminated because it's not to the king's profit to keep them around." Now just think for a moment about what Haman does not tell the king. Haman doesn't tell the king which people he plans to wipe out. Haman doesn't tell the king what it is about their laws that is so troubling. And he doesn't tell Xerxes why it was that this people posed such a threat to the king's welfare. Xerxes, however, isn't fazed in the slightest. He isn't bothered at all about the absence of what I think most of us would consider to be very pertinent information. And he not only agrees to Haman's proposal, he actually gives Haman unfettered authority to carry out his plans. That's the significance of this business about the signet ring in verse 10. The ring that Xerxes gives to Haman, it's essentially a kind of signature. And so when Xerxes hands Haman his signet ring, he was effectively signing off, and think about this for a moment, he's signing off in advance on anything that Haman might decide to do in order to destroy the Jews. Now the question becomes then, why was Xerxes so willing to simply hand over power and let Haman have his way? What was it that convinced him to authorize the slaughter of an entire people without even bothering to find out who those people were? Well, the short answer to that question is profit. The slightly more complicated answer is self-preservation. Now, we need to remember what we learned last week about the consequences of Xerxes' failed military campaigns against the Greeks. We remember from last week that when Xerxes had come back to Persia, he'd not only come back in defeat, but he had come back impoverished. The reality is that in the ancient world, cash-strapped kings tended to have very short lifespans. So when Haman comes to Xerxes, and he offers him 10,000 talents of silver as an enticement to endorse his plan, Xerxes all but leaps out of his seat to seize the opportunity. And that's because this is a lot of money. I mean, like a lot of money. Rough estimates, and it's very difficult to be precise about numbers in the ancient world, but rough estimates suggest that Haman was offering to pay what amounted to somewhere between one-third and one-half of the annual taxation revenue of the whole of the empire. One-third to one-half of the annual taxes of the whole of the empire. That, brothers and sisters, that ain't pocket change. Now, how is Haman going to get that money? Where is he going to come up with that kind of cash? Who knows? At a minimum, we can assume that Haman planned to plunder the wealth and the property of the Jews once he had killed them all. But ultimately, we really can't be sure how Haman planned to make good on that offer. What we can be sure of, however, is that Xerxes didn't care. What Haman was offering was enough money
to stabilize Xerxes' hold on power. What Haman was offering was enough money to let Xerxes do the things that ancient kings love to do. And what is it that ancient kings love to do? Two things. They love to build stuff, and they loved to make war. And the reality is that Xerxes then is being offered a vast sum of money, and so he signs on without so much as inquiring about who Haman planned to slaughter or why he even wanted them dead. Now, brothers and sisters, it turns out that the character of Xerxes' forgetfulness might have, as out of character as Xerxes' forgetfulness might have been, and as appalling as his casual disregard for human life certainly is, we've got to realize that this morning as we read this passage, we are being taught a number of very important lessons here. First of all, we're once again being given a clear picture of the world that we live in as God's children. And what we're being reminded of this morning is that we live in a world that is filled with Xerxes. Now, some of these people in our world, they might have succeeded in reaching positions of power in the same way that Xerxes did. And it's also true that a shocking number of them end up behaving exactly like Xerxes when they do. But the reality is that many, many more of these Xerxes, they live next door to us as our neighbors. And so there's a reminder here for us to think very seriously. We've got to think very seriously about the world that we live in. And there's a call to us this morning not to become too comfortable in that world. In fact, there's a reminder here to us this morning that we should expect that as God's children, more often than not, we will experience hardship, and we will experience the betrayal of those around us as they prove to be both forgetful and self-interested. But what we also need to recognize is that even their forgetfulness and their self-interest, those things remain under God's sovereign direction and control. But this is so important, and it's so important in light of what we learned last Sunday. The reality is this: because they are not his children, God does not take them. He does not move them from where they are. No, because they're not God's children, he leaves them where they are. And that includes leaving them to fall prey to the consequences of their own sinful desires and designs. And knowing that is something that should be of enormous comfort to us as God's people. Brothers and sisters, from time to time, and very much in recent days, fears about global conspiracies rear their heads. And at the center of those fears is usually the idea that somewhere out there, a group of very rich and very powerful people, that they are conspiring together to do things like predetermine the outcome of elections, or to seize control of the global economy, or to lay waste to human rights and freedoms. Now, maybe that's true, and maybe it's not. But let's be clear, from the Christian perspective, that is not, in fact, the relevant question. No, for the Christian, the relevant question is this: what would it matter if there were? What would it matter if there were? Look, brothers and sisters, let's imagine for a moment that out there in the world this morning, there is some kind of secret society, and that this secret society is made up of super rich people. Let's imagine that they meet periodically somewhere like Davos, Switzerland, and that they plot to strip the world's people of their freedom and wealth. Well, let me ask you a question. As Christians, should it surprise us at all that wicked and unregenerate people are out there doing wicked and unregenerate things? Should it surprise us that people who don't know God, that people who don't serve God, that they are instead focused first and foremost on their own welfare, and that such people, just like Xerxes, that they're willing to sacrifice the welfare of millions of people in order to secure their own wealth and power. Brothers and sisters, we need to see that just as the Persian Empire is used in the book of Esther as a stand-in for all the kingdoms of men, so Xerxes, he is set before us as a representative. Xerxes is a representative of all the sons of men. And we need to remember that the only difference between Xerxes and anyone else in that Persian Empire was the fact that, at least for a moment, Xerxes had been able to claw his way to the top of the pyramid. But remember again what we learned last week. The people over whom Xerxes ruled, they were willing to turn a blind eye to all his wickedness. They were willing to turn a blind eye to all of his atrocity. And why? Because they were trying to become him. We need to understand that Xerxes' forgetfulness, as well as his naked self-interest and his callous disregard for human life, they are being set before us as a statement about the normative condition of the unregenerate human heart. God is saying to us, this is what life without me looks like. This is what life in a heart that isn't dominated by my love, this is what it looks like. And in that sense, Xerxes' cruelty, it can only be really differentiated in degree rather than in kind from what lives in the hearts of each and every fallen sinner. And so we should not be surprised when these kinds of atrocities not only happen, but when they are orchestrated by powerful people who are exclusively motivated, just as Xerxes was, by a desire to shore up their own position and power. Xerxes looked out and said, well, you're going to kill some people, but whatever. I'm going to get rich. He couldn't be bothered to even think about who was going to get slaughtered because all he cared about was himself. And God is saying to us this morning, that's the unregenerate human heart. That's how that heart functions. Now, brothers and sisters, we shouldn't be surprised by that. But it's also true that we shouldn't panic when we are confronted with that reality. Because if we pay very close attention to what the Lord is teaching us in this chapter, we will see that ultimately there is no reason for fear. And why is that? Because it turns out that the naked self-interest of the unregenerate human heart is precisely what will cause the plans of the wicked to come to nothing. It's precisely what will undo them. It is precisely what will lay waste to their plans. I want you to think about this for a moment. I want you to imagine, in your mind, I want you to imagine a group of people who have come together to pursue a common goal. Now, I want you to imagine that the pursuit of that goal, that it requires the pursuit of complex and coordinated behavior over a long period of time. So imagine that you're a group of rich people and you want to take over the world. That's going to involve very complicated and very complex action and thinking over a long period of time. By necessity, at some point, the pursuit of that goal will require that the people who are involved in this plan are going to have to lay aside their own self-interest if they're going to successfully achieve their aims. Brothers and sisters, what is the reality? Laying aside self-interest is something that the unregenerate human heart simply isn't capable of doing. I want you to just imagine for a moment again the way that you know that the book of Esther unfolds. Spoiler alert, things aren't going to turn out very well for Haman. Sure, at the end of chapter 3, Xerxes and Haman are drinking buddies, but that only lasts for the very few brief moments that their interests appear to be aligned. But we know how this story ends, don't we? In the moment that Xerxes realized that Haman had manipulated him, in the moment that Xerxes realized that Haman had manipulated him into signing a law that would result in the execution of a loyal servant and a faithful queen, Xerxes becomes enraged. And in his rage, Xerxes ends up executing Haman for daring to use royal authority to pursue his own agenda. And the key point here, beloved, is that we are shown the truth of what we read in Proverbs 34. Proverbs 34, verse 21 says this, "Surely evil will slay the wicked. Surely evil will slay the wicked. Their own wicked hearts, hearts that are dominated by self-interest and greed, their own wicked hearts will be the very things that keep them from achieving their goals. They will turn on themselves as surely as the sun rises in the east, because without the sanctifying power of God at work in their hearts, they will never be able to lay aside self-interest long enough to pursue something that is larger than themselves. In the end, what will be the fate of the wicked? They will claw and they will tear at themselves. And ultimately, they will bring about their own undoing and they will bring about their own ruin." That is exactly what happens to Haman. All the wickedness, all the plotting, all the scheming. And where does he end up? Hung on his own gallows by the very man that he had tried to manipulate in the pursuit of his own self-interest. Once again, beloved, God speaks to us in the words of this story. He comes to us here this morning and he says, "Here is the power of men, but don't be afraid. I know the plans of the wicked," God says, "and in my sovereign good pleasure, I've chosen to leave them. You I am taking, you, my covenant people, I am taking you from where you are and I'm leading you to where you need to be. But the wicked, no, the wicked, I've left them. I've left them where they are. I've left them to endure the consequences of their rebellion and their choices. And so you may be assured that no matter how much they plot, no matter how much they scheme, their efforts will accomplish nothing more than their own undoing." What a rich comfort that is for us as God's people. To know that God's sovereignty is so absolute that he is not only capable of turning all sin and evil to the benefit of his children, but he is able to use the designs of the wicked as a means of bringing about their own destruction. But beloved, there is still more. There is still more here in these verses, because as those who read the words of this text with the eyes of faith, we take note. We take note of the disparity between the recording of Mordecai's deeds in the annals of the king and Xerxes' apparent forgetfulness. And we realize that there is nothing coincidental about these events. In fact, we realize that these are, in fact, clues. They are clues. They are breadcrumbs, if you will. Breadcrumbs which indicate that far from being absent, the Lord is very much at work here. And that's tremendously comforting, because without that knowledge, what follows in the remainder of this chapter would be nothing short of terrifying. Because what happens as this chapter unfolds? We watch as Haman takes hold of royal authority. We watch as he takes the king's signet ring and he sets about executing his heinous plan. We learn that in due course, a date is set for the slaughter of the Jews. And having determined the date of their destruction, Haman sees to it that decrees informing the king's subject about what's going to occur and when it will happen, those decrees are written in every language of the empire, and they're dispatched to every province over which Xerxes ruled. And there's something quite remarkable. There's something quite remarkable about the date on which those decrees are published. These decrees that Haman sends out in the name of the king, they are literally published the day before the celebration of the Passover was to begin. Just as God's people are about to rejoice, they're about to rejoice in their deliverance from slavery and oppression in Egypt, just as they are about to rejoice with the celebration of the Passover, they are hit with the news that their current overlords have set a time and a date for their extermination. And our text tells us that, quite understandably, this news was met with great consternation, especially on the part of the people who lived in Susa. Everybody, Jews and Gentiles alike, are flummoxed and they're frightened by what's happening. One moment the Jews were stable, prosperous citizens of the empire, and in the very next breath they've been slated for destruction. And everybody is wondering, how could this possibly have happened? What circumstances have led to the sudden and the dramatic reversal of fortune for the Jews? It's a fair question. And after reading through this passage, it's one we might have as well. Because surely we've got to wonder how things could have escalated so quickly. And how could they have progressed to such extremes? Well, the short answer to that question is Mordecai. Or more specifically, Mordecai's refusal to bow before Haman as he passed through the palace gates. Now, we know that Mordecai's refusal to pay homage to Haman and Haman's subsequent outrage were what precipitated these events, we must confess that there is an awful lot that we don't know. There's much that we haven't been told about what transpired. First of all, we don't know why it was that Mordecai, who to this point has proven himself quite willing to abide by the laws of the king and to conform to Persian life and customs, why is it that Mordecai suddenly decides that he is not going to obey the king in this matter? Equally, we're left stunned and baffled by the intensity of Haman's rage and his desire for revenge. It's a scenario that's actually reminiscent about Vashti's affair in chapter 1. There in chapter 1, the rebellion of a single woman somehow generates fears that all the women in Persia will follow suit. And now, as a consequence of one man's disrespect, an entire population is punished for his behavior. And again, as we read these verses, we might be left wondering, how can that be? What was it about these circumstances that could possibly have resulted in such an extreme reaction on Haman's part? Now, brothers and sisters, the way that both of those questions tend to get answered, especially in Reformed commentaries and sermons, is by pointing out the respective ancestries of these two men. You'll note as you read through the text how often Mordecai is spoken of as being Mordecai the Jew, and how Haman is repeatedly identified as an Agagite. Further, in chapter 2, we learned that Mordecai was a Benjaminite and that he was a descendant of a man named Kish. Now, here's the thing. If the Kish being referred to is the Kish who was the father of King Saul, then that would mean that what we see unfolding in the pages of Esther 3 is a rematch of the confrontation between King Saul and King Agag, which had happened centuries ago. And that had been a pivotal moment in Israel's history. And if we were to trace the lines of Haman's descent even further back, we discover that there's an even greater example of conflict in Israel's past, because Agag had been a descendant of Amalek. And it had been the Amalekites who had tried to destroy the Israelites as they journeyed through the wilderness on their way to Canaan. And if we went even further back in time, we discover that Amalek was a descendant of Esau. And so we'd find ourselves arriving back in the household of Isaac, bearing witness to the conflict between two sons, Jacob and Esau. And the point is that if we follow this approach, then the ferocity of the conflict that erupts between Mordecai and Haman It can be explained as being yet another chapter in that age-old conflict between the house of Israel and the house of Amalek. And then we say to ourselves, well, of course Mordecai refused to bow to a hated enemy of God's people. And of course, when presented with the opportunity, then Haman seized upon that opportunity to try to destroy the Jews. Both men were simply acting out an age-old conflict, the age-old conflict of generations past. Now, as compelling as that explanation might be, there are a number of reasons to be cautious about adopting that view. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it this morning, but I just want to make a few quick observations. First of all, Haman is identified as Haman the Agagite, and it seems that this is intended to convey a sense of nationality. And if that's the case, it seems rather odd that Haman isn't identified as being an Amalekite, because that's the people from whom he'd ultimately be descended. And in connection with that, scholars have suggested that Agag may have been a province or a territory within the confines of the Persian Empire. Further, in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, Haman has a number of different names. Sometimes he's Haman the Agagite, sometimes he's Haman the Macedonian, and sometimes he's Haman the Bugian. In fact, it seems that it wasn't until much later, with the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus, that Haman is specifically identified as being an Agagite. We might also wonder if the Kish who is identified as being Mordecai's forefather is in fact the same Kish who was the father of Saul. And finally, it is worth asking this question. Why is it that at this time in Israel's history and in the hour of their greatest need that God would choose to raise up a savior from the line of Saul? Why would God rehabilitate the family of a king he'd cut off far back in the narrative of redemption history? Now, I realize that these observations may come as something of a letdown, insofar as a rematch between these two ancient households, it provides us with a tidy, ribbon-wrapped explanation for what's happening. And I also realize that that leaves us hungry for an answer about why things play out the way that they do. Because as readers, we're left wondering, well, what is the point of all this? Why are we told this information? How are we supposed to make sense of what's happening in this chapter? Well, brothers and sisters, let me suggest this to you. Our God is a master storyteller. And we have already seen how several times in the opening chapters, what God does is he changes the camera focus. We saw that in chapter 1. The camera focus was the empire as a whole. Then in the beginning of chapter 2, it narrows down to the heart of that empire. Then in the end of chapter 2, the camera focus shifts out to say, what is it like to live as citizens of that empire? Well, what I believe God is doing here is that he is shifting the camera focus once more, and he is helping us see things from a different perspective. And my suggestion is that here in these verses, what we are finding is that he is teaching us a lesson about the nature of history. And what is it that he is trying to teach us about the nature of history? Well, what he's trying to teach us here is that we need to be aware of what lies beneath the events of our day-to-day lives. And what lies beneath the events of history, be it the rise and fall of empires, or the behavior of everyday citizens in a kingdom like Persia, or even in a country like Canada, what lies beneath the daily events of our lives is an ongoing battle, an ongoing cosmic struggle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and it is the existence of this struggle that the Lord is trying to draw our attention to this morning. Now, what is it about our text that alerts us to the fact that this is the lesson that the Lord is trying to drive home? Well, there are several details that are significant here. First of all is Haman's use of the lot in order to determine the date of the execution for the Jews. The point here is that Haman won't move forward with his plan until he has consulted the powers and the spiritual authorities of his world. reality is that as Haman rolls the dice to determine the date of the destruction of the Jews, he is consulting the dark forces and the dark powers that rule over the children of men. And there's a hint there that what's at play here, what is operating beneath the surface of the physical events, is a cosmic battle that is occurring behind the scenes. And secondly, there's the repeated identification as Mordecai, repeated identification of Mordecai as the Jew and Haman as the Agagite. Now, while we might not be able to be certain that Haman was a genetic descendant of the Amalekites, what we can be certain of is that he was absolutely opposed to God's people. And in that sense, what we need to do is we need to actually draw the line of Haman's ancestry back further. And we need to draw it all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Because whatever else Haman might have been, he is certainly a descendant of the serpent. And his desire to see the people of God destroyed is evidence of the enmity that God had said would exist. The enmity that would exist between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And that enmity has existed from the moment that Adam and Eve were set outside of the garden, and it will continue to exist until the moment that Christ returns in glory. And I want you to think about what we read from Revelation this morning. What have we read? We read that not only will the enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent exist until the end of time, but it will intensify as the day of judgment draws near. The beast has been given authority to make war on the people of God. And that's what the Lord wants us to learn from these verses. He wants us to learn that the conflict which springs up between Mordecai and Haman and its escalation to a genocidal level, it is not important first and foremost because of what it tells us about the flesh and blood struggle between God's people and their enemies. No, it's important because of what it teaches us about the spiritual battle that is being waged behind the scenes. The Lord comes to us this morning and he says, open your eyes and look past what is happening in time and space and see what lies beneath. Recognize that the true struggle that is occurring here is a spiritual one. And then the Lord comes to us this morning and he says, understand that if you are one of my children, if you belong to me, then you are engaged in that very same struggle, and the stakes are just as high. This is exactly what the Apostle Paul will teach us later in Ephesians 6. Paul will come to us and he will say, we need to be aware of what, Paul says, that our struggle is not with flesh and blood. Our struggle is with the cosmic powers of this present darkness. And I think that's why the Lord doesn't provide us with all the historical information that we'd like to know about these events. That's why as we read through this passage, not all the details that we might like to know are there, because ultimately they don't really matter to the lesson that God is trying to teach us. He doesn't want us to become fixated on the flesh and blood struggle between two men. He wants us to learn to see what lies beneath. He wants us to be aware of what's happening because, once again, he wants us to be aware that he is in control. That's the purpose of the clues. That's the purpose of the breadcrumbs in this passage. He's placed them here as signs for us as his children, signs that are there to alert us to the fact that he is present and active, not just in history, but behind it. And as always, God is working to protect. He's working to promote the welfare of his children. And brothers and sisters, what was true in the days of Esther, it continues to be true today. And what's marvelous is that unlike our brothers and sisters in the Old Covenant, our brothers and sisters in the Old Covenant who had to be content with the breadcrumbs and the clues and the shadows, we have been given more than that. For we have been given the entire loaf. For we have seen and we have known the one who is the bread of life, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And therefore, we have even greater comfort as we endure the afflictions of our age. Brothers and sisters, wicked men and wicked women are going to come. And they're going to plot. And they're going to scheme in our time as well. And no doubt, many of those wicked men and women, they are seeking to destroy the church. They want to lay waste to your freedoms. They want to take away your ability to worship. But we remain in the care of the one who says to us, "Take heart, for I have overcome the world." We remain in his care, and there is no power in heaven, no power on earth that can separate us from his love. The children of darkness will come, and they will rage, they will attack, they will hurt, and they will harm. Revelation tells us that some of us will be taken to captivity. Some of us will face the sword. That's what John says. When the time to come to captivity goes, you go. When the time of the sword comes, the sword falls. But we remain in his care. The children of darkness will be undone and destroyed. But the children of light will be preserved in peace. And they will go from strength to strength. Amen.